Welcome to Your Health. I'm Rebecca Davis. In today's program, there's good news about your aging brain and insights into the teenage brain. We'll hear from James Wong on the fine art of growing drugs and food rules. Are you a follower or a breaker? But first, teenage brains and this story of one frustrated scientist mom who decided to learn exactly what was going on inside her son's head. Richard Knox has more.
When her two sons hit adolescence, Frances Jensen found herself saying the same thing over and over again.
What were you thinking? You know, this is a resounding mantra of parents and teachers.
Jensen couldn't fathom her teenager's behavior. The surly moods, the exasperating changes of plans, the assumption that somebody else will pick up their dirty clothes. Now, Jensen's a pediatric neurologist at Children's Hospital in Boston, but her own teens suddenly seemed like aliens.
I thought, you know, I'm going to try to understand what's going on with this species, you know, these teenagers that we're living with.
What really got her into gear was her older son, Andrew. It was when he turned 16.
He's a very compliant kid, was a great kid, and then his grades started to slip, and this hadn't been an issue before.
I did dumb things, yeah. I got in trouble with the school sometimes for just not really caring, doing really poorly in classes.
He dyed his hair black with red streaks, started going off to school in studded leather and platform shoes.
I watched my child morph into another being, yet I knew deep down inside it was the same Andrew.
As Jensen dug up studies on teenage brains, she discovered it's not so much what they're thinking, it's how. Jensen says scientists used to think that the teen brain is just an adult brain with fewer miles on it. It's not. To begin with, a crucial part of the brain, the frontal lobe, is not fully connected.
It's the part of the brain that says, is this a good idea? What is the consequence of this action?
It turns out that the nerve cells that connect teenagers' frontal lobes with the rest of their brain don't work very well. They're sluggish. This is a little complicated, but it's really interesting. Teenagers don't have as much of the fatty coating called myelin that adult brains have in this area. Think of it as insulation on an electrical wire. Nerves need myelin for nerve signals to flow freely.
It's not that they don't have a frontal lobe, and they can use it. They're going to access it more slowly.
This might explain what was going on in the brain of Jensen's younger son, Will, when he was 16. He's a straight arrow student, good grades, high SAT scores, but one morning on the way to school, he turned left into oncoming traffic. He and the other driver were okay, but there was serious damage to the car.
It was totaled. It was down and out, so had to get a towed away.
And lo and behold, who was the other driver? It was a 21-year-old, also probably not with a completely connected frontal lobe.
Jensen says this also helps explain why teenagers often seem so maddeningly self-centered.
You think of them as these surly, rude, selfish people. Well, actually, that's the developmental stage they're at. They aren't yet at that place where they're thinking about or capable necessarily of thinking about the effects of their behavior on others. That requires insight.
And insight requires, that's right, a fully connected frontal lobe. But that's not the only big difference in teenagers' brains. In children and adolescents, nature made the brain to be excitable, responsive to everything in the environment. That's what makes kids learn so easily. But this can work in ways that are not so good. Take alcohol, for example.
Addiction has been shown to be essentially a form of learning. So they're tapping into a much more robust habit-forming ability that adolescents have compared to adults.
This came in handy in Jensen's own household.
Most parents they'll say, don't drink, don't do drugs. And I'm the type of kid who would say, why?
That's Will, son number two. When he asked why, his mom could give him chapter and verse about how drug effects linger for days. So if her boys were tempted, they knew what to say to themselves.
It's a fact that, you know, if I smoke pot tonight and I have an exam in 2 days' time, I'm going to do worse. It's a fact.
Will says having a neuroscientist for a mom was helpful with his homework, too. Like when he was tempted to pull an all-nighter.
She would say, read it all tonight and then go to sleep. And what she explained to me is that will take it from your short-term memory, what you have been reading and what you know now, and while you sleep, it will consolidate it. And actually, you will know it better in the morning than right before when you went to sleep.
He says it worked every time. His older brother Andrew, the former goth, agrees. He's now a senior in physics at Wesleyan University.
I think she's great. I would not be where I am without her in my life.
As a parent myself who survived two teenagers, I can tell you there are no sweeter words. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston. Boston.
Well, I hope that was helpful. Now, what about the middle-aged brain? Is the news good? Here's Michelle Trudeau.
Just as in adolescence, there's good news and bad news about the brain in middle age, and ways researchers tell us to maintain good brain health. First, the bad news for us middle-agers.
Reaction time is slower. It takes us longer to learn new information.
That's research psychiatrist Gary Small from UCLA.
Sometimes it takes us longer to retrieve information, so we have that tip-of-the-tongue phenomenon. That's typical of a middle-aged brain.
Any more bad news?
We're not so great at multitasking. We're quick, but we're sloppy. We make more errors when we're middle-aged.
Is there any good news?
Complex reasoning is very good when we get older, as we age.
Small explains that myelination, the insulation wrapped around each nerve cell that increases conductivity, reaches its maximum in middle age.
So that means that the neural circuits fire more rapidly. So you're going from dial-up to DSL.
And Small adds empathy to our plus column.
If you design an experiment and you present several options for a young person, they're more likely to choose a more narcissistic option than one that tends to take into account the other person's interests and point of view than, say, a middle-aged or older person would.
One of the great discoveries from recent neuroscience research is that our brains are always changing, always developing, even able to grow new brain cells. In a recent study, one he calls Your Brain on Google, Gary Small trained healthy middle-aged folks who were novices on the computer to do Google searches. They practiced searching online an hour a day for a week, and then came back into the lab for brain scans. The scans showed significant increases in brain activity in the areas that control memory and decision-making.
One interpretation of that is that with practice, very quickly, an older brain can alter its neurocircuitry, can strengthen those neurocircuits, controlling working memory, controlling decision-making areas of the brain.
Research by neuroscientist Art Kramer at the University of Illinois demonstrates the plasticity, or the ability to grow and change, of the aging brain. In his studies on physical exercise, memory improves with aerobic treadmill training.
So what we find is that over a six-month to a one-year period, 3 days a week, working up to an hour a day, that people improve in various aspects of both short-term and long-term memory.
And people who exercised had larger hippocampi, a critical memory center. Other brain areas, too, central for decision-making, planning, and multitasking, were also larger than when they began the aerobic exercise program.
There are a number of regions that on MRI scans tend to show not just stability, but increases as a function of exercise in middle-aged and older brains.
And these scientists are walking the walk. For all you baby boomers out there with middle-aged brains, here's what Dr. Kramer, age 56, and next Dr. Small, age 58, do to keep their own brains healthy.
Before this interview, I was over at the gym, and I was riding a stationary bike and reading a few newspapers, and I was also lifting weights.
And I'll start out in the New York Times and I'll do Ken, and then either I'll solve it or I get to the point where I screwed it up and then I move on to the crossword. That's my typical day.
For NPR News, I'm Michelle Trudeau.
And now for growing your own drugs, the legal kind, the kind you can grow in your own backyard, into a living pharmacy of fennel and rosehip, echinacea, and dandelion. Ethnobotanist James Wong joined Melissa Block to discuss his new medicinal recipe book, Grow Your Own Drugs, which is an offshoot of his BBC television series.
James, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you say at the outset, James, you are not against conventional medicine, but you look all around you at plants and you see these little, bright, beautiful chemical factories.
That's a really good way of putting it, actually. I think so many people have this stereotyped idea of what herbal medicine is. And it's, I think they've almost got a big black line in their minds that separates serious, conventional, tested scientific medicine on one side and slightly airy-fairy, away with the hippies, you know, natural but probably doesn't work, plant-based medicine on another. And I think it's really important as a scientist to show that this sort of big black line that so many people have in their minds is really a cultural idea, not a scientific one. You know, to me as a scientist, whether a chemical is found within a pill or the cells of a plant is really irrelevant. I mean, that's just packaging. It's whether, you know, there's a plausibility that it works or not. So I'm totally not against conventional medicine. I mean, I'm the person who's popping aspirin whenever I've got the opportunity. But, you know, if I'm at home and I've got things to hand, I might well make an extract using willow bark, for example, an extract using meadowsweet, which are the plants that aspirin was first derived from, and in many senses can be seen as in some ways superior and in some ways practical, depending on your situation.
You have recipes in this book for remedies for just a wide range of ailments, everything from hot flashes to eczema to arthritis. And I want to talk about your treatment for something that has driven so many parents and children to complete distraction, head lice.
Conventional medicine or conventional treatments for head lice, in the UK at least, are proving increasingly problematic in treating head lice because head lice are becoming immune to the chemicals that are traditionally used. So there is a big interest in looking at alternatives. And one of these is neem oil that we use. Neem oil works in an entirely different way as an insecticide. It actually mimics the chemicals, hormones that an insect has in its body. And it basically sends off the wrong chemical messages to the insect. So it produces lots of problems with it feeding, it reproducing, and it molting. But it's entirely safe for all mammals, just toxic to insects.
What is neem oil?
Neem oil is an oil that's produced from a tree, a subtropical tree native to India, and it's quite widely available in health food shops, and it's not particularly expensive either.
I can imagine skeptical parents everywhere right now listening to this and wondering, does it really work?
Well, I would say to that, give it a go. As with all herbal remedies, they don't necessarily come with guarantees. And if you've tried conventional stuff and it hasn't, I don't think there's any harm in giving it a go.
And you have the neem oil in your recipe mixed up with almond oil, garlic cloves, tea tree oil, rosemary, lavender, I guess, just to smell pretty.
Actually, all of those ingredients have been used traditionally for their insecticidal properties. It's the essential oils within them that's the key insecticidal compound. I think in human terms, when you think of how long we've been battling with insects, you're talking a couple of thousand years. When you think about how long plants have been waging sort of warfare with insects, this goes back millions of years. And over that huge period, there's been time for them to evolve all sorts of unusual strategies, many of which are natural chemical weapons, insecticides that exist in the environment that can be used in all manner of ways. It's really many of the recipes that I've used are basically about hijacking chemicals that plants have evolved for themselves and using them to treat people and animals.
You have a recipe in here for treating athlete's foot with a garlic foot bath, a lot of garlic, some sage leaves, cider vinegar, and that you say will cure what ails you if you've got athlete's foot.
Well, all of those ingredients have antifungal properties, particularly garlic, and in particular the concentration that we're using them at. Plenty of garlic, plenty of sage, plenty of lavender, and one of my key things that I wanted to get across in this book and series is that natural medicine doesn't have to be about trekking off to the Amazon. It's about plants that are growing in and around your neighborhood that are accessible to you. And, you know, when you're thinking about lavender and sage, so many people have got them in their back garden anyway. And things like garlic and sage are probably in your spice rack. It's about things that are easy and accessible, and you don't need any more equipment than, you know, I used to have in my student kitchen when I knocked them up at university.
Now, a few caveats we should toss in here. You say if you're sick, you should, of course, talk to your doctor. Do not self-diagnose.
Very much so. I'm an ethnobotanist by training, which is a scientist that studies the use of plants. I'm not medically trained. There are all sorts of interesting solutions that are found in the plant world. But, you know, you need to be responsible. You need to make sure that you have a proper diagnosis and know exactly what you've got. And, you know, once you've got that, you can consider using plant-based remedies as part of the solution. But it's very much not about abandoning conventional medicine. It's almost like a useful complement to it.
And also you say, know what you're picking. Be very careful of poisonous plants, of course.
That's a very important thing. I think, you know, as a botanist, it's quite easy to forget that to the layman, you know, there are lots of poisonous plants that are morphologically in their shape very, very similar to perfectly useful plants. And it really is important to get a good guidebook and, you know, visually identify exactly what you're looking for.
James, do you have an all-time favorite medicinal plant?
oh gosh, it really is like picking between your children. You might have one, but you wouldn't like to say it to make the other ones feel bad. What would I say? I'd say probably garlic. It's my favourite, although it's not particularly exotic and far-flung and unusual. But it's my favourite probably because of all those things. It's so widely available. You can get it in whichever country in the world you're at. So easy to grow. It tastes brilliant, but it has such a huge range of medicinal uses. It's antifungal, it's antibacterial, and it's antiviral. So really, with all of those uses combined, it's just such a one-stop shop. You just have to pick it.
James Wong is the author of Grow Your Own Drugs. James, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Whether you are someone who thinks and worries about food all the time or just around the holidays, wouldn't it be helpful to have a few easy rules to follow? Well, for those of you who would like to eat healthier but you can't bear to hear about the latest fad diet, you're in luck. NPR's Art Silverman has some fresh advice for you.
Most people assume that even if they eat well, they won't be able to live for 1,000 years or forever. But they do want to stay healthy and happy for their entire lives, then die a painless and quick death doing something heroic. Is that too much to ask? So many people try to pay attention to what they eat. It becomes a religion to them. They set down rules. We sampled some people's rules in a Washington suburb to hear how they vary.
My food rule is that I'm really, really picky about my meat. Like, who's making it? I want to know where it's coming from.
I eat one thing on the plate at a time till it's gone, then I move on to the next. So I eat salad, then meat, then vegetables.
I usually avoid having pancakes or waffles or anything.
When it comes to sweets and cookies, I put them in my mouth, I taste it, then I spit it out.
I will only eat the food if I know exactly who has made that food.
I usually don't eat things out of plastic bags.
We're kind of lost in what has become a very treacherous food landscape. Eating has gotten really complex.
That's Michael Pollan. He's a crusader for changing the way we think about food, and he thinks we think about what we eat in ways that just don't make sense. He doesn't care much for those fads that create a mythology around proper ways to eat. He has a common sense slogan, which is, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Michael Pollan's latest book is called Food Rules.
This is a book that you can read in about 20 minutes or a half hour, and it's got 64 rules. Not all of them are going to stick, but my hope is that a couple will stick and that they will kind of be part of your bag of tricks when you enter the supermarket or the farmer's market. So I'm not expecting anyone to memorize 64 rules. In fact, a lot of them take you to the same place. You know, the rule, you know, don't eat anything that your grandmother wouldn't recognize as food is not so different than the rule that says don't eat any foods you've seen advertised on television.
And Michael Pollan suggests other common sense rules that are cloaked in humor. Here's rule 21.
It's not food if it's called by the same name in every language.
By that, Michael Pollan means Big Mac, Pringles, Cheetos. Rule 19.
If it came from a plant, eat it. If it was made in a plant, don't.
It's sort of like an extended Ten Commandments to keep you from straying from the path of wellness.
We do have a very religious view of food. Whenever we're eating, we think that this activity takes place on a spectrum, at one end of which is we're ruining our health because we're eating the junk we want to eat, and at the other end of the spectrum, we're redeeming our health. And I really think that that's a shame because in my own experience, the best food for your health is the most pleasurable food, and there is not a trade-off between eating well and eating pleasurably.
But in truth, people stumble way outside the orthodoxy of food rules. And by publishing this book, Michael Pollan sets himself up to be thought of as a high priest of eating right. When word got around NPR that Michael Pollan had food rules, colleagues who strayed felt the need to confess. The first was reporter Ari Shapiro.
Forgive me, Michael Pollan, for I have committed a food sin. I was just in Austin, Texas, and I drowned in queso.
You know, I'm not sure that that does break the rules. I'd have to see the recipes. If it's really Velveeta, my attitude is don't eat foods that are pretending to be something they're not.
Well, thank you for absolving me of my food sin.
Next into the confessional booth was producer Neil Carruth.
Forgive me, Michael Pollan, but I've committed the food sin of eating way too much candy.
Candy. It's a special occasion food. It's a treat. Don't stop eating candy, but just think about when you have it and if you can put it back up on its pedestal of being special.
And finally, our cake lady came by, producer Melissa Gray, author of All Cakes Considered.
Forgive me, Michael Pollan, for I have sinned. In addition to the cake that I push on the staff every Monday, I also have a weakness, an indulgence, for Chef Boyardee beef ravioli in a can.
Now that's nasty.
No, it's not.
Well, you know, if you enjoy Chef Boyardee beef ravioli and I don't, that's fine. It's fine. But I've also been to the feedlots where that meat was produced. That's, you know, the little bit of it that's in the middle of those things. And, you know, I have a little more trouble with it than you do. You know, I really don't like this role of being food superego to people like you. I'm really sorry. But there is no one proper way to eat. And anyone who tells you that is crazy.
Unlike the tablets that came down from Mount Sinai, Michael Pollan includes one final commandment Moses never thought of.
Rule number 64 is you should break the rules from time to time.
Amen. That's Michael Pollan. The book is Food Rules, Wisdom for Those Among Us Who Tend to Eat Food. Art Silverman, NPR News.
And that's all for Your Health. Please join us again next week for more of the best from the Health Desk here at NPR. I'm Rebecca Davis, and thanks for listening.